Well, I'd like to thank you all for coming out. Try to make room if you can. It's one of those cold evenings in Wyoming, windy, so it's a little sparse, but that's all right. We are studying the book of 1 Kings, and it's been very, very good. I've enjoyed it. We're still talking about Solomon. We have another chapter to talk about Solomon. Sad to say, the downfall, but right now we're looking at Solomon's glory. So this is going to be chapter 10, verses 14 through 29. So it'll be the end of the chapter, and it will talk about his wealth and some of the other things that he has done. And we've looked at this, but now we're going to look at it in detail. And so this is, again, 1 Kings chapter 10, verses 14 through 29. Before we begin, though, let's begin with a word of prayer. Our Father and our God, as we come before you, again, everything in Scripture is for our learning and also for our example. On the one hand, we learn that you kept your promises to Solomon. We understand that this was the glorious age. But on the other hand, we learn that we must be careful and always be on guard because small compromises will eventually cause a downfall. And we can start to see some of these seeds already at the end of this chapter. But nevertheless, it's still the glory that you gave him in answer to his prayer. And so, Father, may we always remember to ask you for wisdom, ask you for provisions, and to trust in you solely. We ask you now to bless this time together. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. All right, so if you'll turn in your Bibles to 1 Kings, and I'd like to read verses 14 through 17. So this is the first section, and it's going to be Solomon's wealth. Then down in verses 18 through 21, it's going to be Solomon's throne. It is a very elaborate throne, and so we're going to take a little look at that, verses 18 through 21. Then we'll take a look at Solomon's imports. And I don't know if you think of the Old Testament as a time when all they do is either walk or have camels. But the truth of the matter is there was many ships and they were already going to seaports really around the known world anyway. And so we're going to look at some of that. We'll look at Solomon's fame, that it was worldwide. And then we'll look at Solomon's military, particularly the horses and also his chariots. So let's look and read verses 14 through 17. It says, "Now the weight of gold which came into Solomon in 1 year was 666 talents of gold. Besides that, from the traders and the wares of the merchants, and all the kings of the Arabs and the governors of the country. King Solomon made 200 large shields of beaten gold, using 600 shekels of gold on each large shield. He made 300 shields of beaten gold, using 3 minas of gold on each shield, and the king put them in the house of the forest of Lebanon." Just talking about some of the wealth. Well, let's just see now here. So what was his annual income from just the gold? Well, it was 666 talents. Well, we'll convert that in just a moment. But I'd like to read an excerpt here. It says, "The 666 talents, 25 tons, represents Solomon's yearly income in gold from all sources, including commerce and taxes. In addition, there was an unspecified amount of income from tolls or tariffs from the various merchants and business agents that traveled through the land, as well as tribute from conquered kings. The Arabian kings of verse 15 were tribal chiefs of miscellaneous peoples living in the desert to the south and to the east. The governors were probably the district governors." Those were spoken of in 1 Kings. So, all right, so how much annually is this? Well, if you go to calculateme.com, it gives you the most recent equations of what the price of gold is. And as of April 7th, 2022, one ton of gold equals 56,246,750 That is a ton of money. And you're thinking of this time, again, when you're thinking of Israel, you're thinking of this dusty desert place, and yet it was a booming, thriving Jerusalem under King Solomon. So this is all about his glory. It's going to conclude with glory before chapter 11, his downfall. Anyway, the question would come up now, well, where did he get all this gold? There probably was some gold in Israel. There was some mining in Timnah, they talk about. But most of the gold would have been imported. And I had said that there really is no archaeology evidence of King Solomon. There is of David, but not of Solomon. It doesn't matter. We have the Bible, so we know it's true. And it probably is just a matter of time before archaeology catches up, and it always does. However, there is a place over in Spain called Rio Tinto. And this is a place that has been mined for centuries. And they believe that Solomon, through the ships of Tyre and also the ships of Tarshish, all of these probably went there and dug for gold and then brought the gold back. You remember he also got gold from Ophir. We just don't know where Ophir is. Should be Gopher, because he would say, go for some more gold. Just kidding. But seriously, there's a couple of articles where a marine archaeologist went not around Israel, but around all of these other areas and seaports, and he started to find Phoenician evidence. Well, what's the idea about Phoenician evidence? Well, Hiram, remember King Hiram of Tyre, was part of the fleet of helping Solomon and then going out. So that's where these Phoenician ships were going. They were going all over Spain and other places. In fact, we'll even see some of the routes in just a moment. And so many of the people who have been part of this archaeology think that this is exactly where one of the places where Solomon got it. In fact, one of the places was named Solomon's Hill. Solomon. So before the archaeologists even got there, one of the hills was called Solomon's Hill. So let me just read a little bit, and then I have some pictures. The Rio Tinto Red River, or Tinto River, is a river in southwestern Spain that rises in the Sierra Morena Mountains of Andalusia. It flows generally south-southwest, reaching the Gulf of Cadiz at Huelva. The Rio Tinto River has a unique red and orange color. In fact, they called one of the spots the wine river because it looks like red wine. It's derived from its chemical makeup that is extremely acidic and with very high levels of iron and heavy metals. Well, some time ago, the Olive Press comes out with an article about this one archaeologist, Dr. Sean Kingsley, where he was the one who, again, it's not proven, but to him, it's very, very likely that this is one of the places where Solomon mined his gold. Of course, when you talk about Solomon's mines, all of a sudden you have mythology, you have Harrison Ford in the mix. But we know for sure that he did mine gold, and this was always being exported. So it says, since 3000 B.C., the Rio Tinto has been mined for copper, silver, gold, and other alloys. So let me go ahead and give you a picture here. So this is one of the pictures of it, and you can see it's kind of like the Badlands. It has all these different colors going through it. Here's where they mine. Now, some of this is from present day mining. They're still mining it. And this particular picture here, I'm pretty sure, because this is the one that was in the article, is the one that was called Solomon's Hill. So this is where they would have went to mine. Now, how did he know the gold was there? Well, he was the smartest guy on the planet at the time. No, but seriously, he would investigate things, and that's part of his knowledge. He knew a lot about, as you remember, early in the chapters of 1 Kings here, we talked about Solomon, that he knew, many different areas of knowledge. Not just the knowledge of the Lord and the fear of the Lord, but knowledge in the species of animals, knowledge into, construction, knowledge of trees, and obviously knowledge of minerals. And so he sent out these ships, and they would bring it back. Now, the Olive Press goes on, although the legendary mines of King Solomon are shrouded in myth and Old Testament allegory, there is tangible archaeological evidence to suggest that much of the opulence of King Solomon's temple was sourced from the Rio Tinto. Now, the myth would not come from the Bible. And I'm not sure what it means when it says Old Testament allegory. This is fact. So hopefully that's not what is meant. Well, in another article called The Guardian, it has this Dr. Sean Kingsley in there, and this is what he said. What turned up in southern Spain is undeniable. Phoenician signature finds richly strewn from Rio Tinto to Malaga leave no doubt that Near Eastern ships voyaged to what must have been the far side of the moon by 900 BC. So there wasn't anything that identified specifically Solomon, but what was Tyre? It was a Phoenician city. It wasn't under, well, they weren't Jewish people. Hiram was a Phoenician king, but they had an alliance, and in fact, Hiram even helped David collect some of the materials for the temple. It says, when I spotted in ancient accounts the name of the hill where silver was mined at Rio Tinto, Solomon's Hill, I was stunned. So in his research, this area had already been called Solomon's Hill. So it's very possible that this is one of the places where he mined. Now, if you take a look at the map here, we've been talking about some of these. We've been talking about Tyre because, again, Hiram, the king, was very helpful to Solomon. They had an allegiance just like David did. And then you have Jerusalem. So the imports would have come into Tyre and then down to Jerusalem. Now, I want you to notice Timnah, if you will, and I couldn't quite get it on the map. That was another place that they believed that he mined. They found some things suggesting that it was mining there. So we're still looking for Solomon's mine, but there are some suggestions that that's where it is, even though we could unfortunately say no conclusive evidence has been found. Now, of course, the world is waiting for that to say, well, there is none, and so we told you that Solomon was just a myth. No, it's just a matter of time. They said that about David until archaeology found in a different place, not in Jerusalem, but in a different place, a record where it talked about King David. So that was conclusive evidence, as if we needed it. By the way, there in Gezer is another place that has been investigated. And they're thinking that this could be another place where they found remains of Solomon's palace, perhaps another palace that he bought or bought. Well, actually, you remember he was given. You remember his first wife was the daughter of the Pharaoh of Egypt. And as a dowry gift, the Pharaoh of Egypt gave Solomon Gezer. It was under Egyptian occupation. Actually, it was under Canaanite occupation till they came in and overtook it. And he says, here, you can have this. So that would have been one of the places where he built his palace. Could have been one of the horse cities that we've already talked about. Which case now, we're talking about, we know three possible places that Solomon built where we can see the type of architecture that was built, and we also know that he had all of these horse cities, which is going to be mentioned in this chapter. So we have Gezer, Megiddo, and Hazor. So Hazor is famous for the slingshot guy that I filmed when we were there. Okay, Megiddo is famous because that's where Armageddon is going to take place. And Gezer, that's where Jewish old people would go to retire. No, just kidding. That is another place that was under Solomon's rule and reign, and most likely that is a picture. Could be. They said it's around the time of Solomon. It's not conclusive yet. But anyway, it could be those ruins there. All right, so we'll look at verses 16 and 17, verse 15 as well, where it says, besides that, from the traders and the wares of the merchants and all the kings of the Arabs and the governors of the country. So he was getting gold from all of them. And some of the kings that were conquered but civilization had not been completely eradicated. They were still around. They were subservient to Israel. And so he was getting a lot of taxation and tariffs and also gold from there. Well, verse 16 is going to talk about the golden shields, verses 16 and 17. It says, King Solomon made 200 large shields of beaten gold, using 600 shekels of gold on each large shield. He made 300 shields of beaten gold, using 3 minas of gold on each shield. And the king put them in the house of the forest of Lebanon. Well, I have another quote. Again, one of the good commentaries on the book of 1 Kings, anyway, is the Expositor's Bible Commentary. I read many good commentaries, but some of them are very detailed and very helpful. And this is one of them. This is what it says. These verses describe the ceremonial shields that Solomon kept in the palace of the forest of Lebanon. Remember, after we looked at Solomon's temple for the Lord, then he built his palace, and we actually looked at the dimensions and we looked at these buildings. These shields, like all the shields of the ancients, were made of wood or basket work and covered with gold plate instead of leather. The large shield was adapted to cover the whole body. I don't know if you ever thought about that, but sometimes there's short shields and sometimes there's long shields, depending on whether it's infantry or whatever, but each has their own purpose. It says being either oval or rectangular like a door. This was carried by the heavy armed infantry. The small shield was carried by archers. You can imagine you want a small shield because you also have to carry arrows and your bow. Each large shield in this case was covered with 600 bekas or 1/2 shekels. The small shield with 3 minas equals 300 bekas, and the weights per shield were about 7 1/2 and 3 3/4 pounds, respectively. So I don't know. I mean, that's probably light for that day, lightweight. But, you know, I imagine if you carry that a long ways, that will get pretty heavy. So this is just showing you the glory of Solomon, of what he had. So all of these shields are gold. Whether these actually saw war or not, we don't know. But here the expositor says that they're ceremonial shields. So they're going to have the 4th of July with all the fireworks. They're going to come out with these shields. Well, whenever they would have any kind of major ceremony, that's when they would bring these out. We move from this to one of the most interesting ones is Solomon's throne. And this is found in verses 18 through 21. So let's take a look at verses 18 through 21, but we're going to slow down around verse 18. All right. It says, "Moreover, the king made a great throne of ivory and overlaid it with refined gold. There were six steps to the throne, and a round top to the throne at its rear, and arms on each side of the seat, and two lions standing beside the arms. 12 lions were standing there on the six steps, on the one side and on the other. Nothing like it was made for any other kingdom." So we see in history, we see other thrones similarly made this way. But it was Solomon who put it together first, according to that passage. Then in verse 21, it says, "All King Solomon's drinking vessels were of gold, and all the vessels of the house of the forest of Lebanon were of pure gold. None was of silver. It was not considered valuable in the days of Solomon." All right, so let's go back to the throne. And I'm thinking, ivory? Where did they get ivory from? Now, you can get ivory from numerous animals, the tusks of a walrus. You can get it from the tooth of an elk. There's various other places where you can get ivory. But the number one place of getting ivory, of course, is from elephants and elephant tusks. So, first of all, I want to just read it. It says here, "The ivory throne, overlaid with finest gold, was a large and imposing object." So it was a big deal. That's why it's being mentioned here. You would come in and that's what you would see. "In keeping with the symbolism of the seat of justice and rulership of a great kingdom, the armrests were flanked by lions, as were each of the six steps." So a couple of pictures here, artist renditions. So someone asked me, well, do you have a lot of pictures of his throne? And I said, no, because the ones that I looked at didn't have all lions on it. Like one was a lion, one was a crocodile, one was a seal. And I'm like, I don't want to do that. So I don't have a picture. And of course, it's all of the artist rendition. So if you remember, here's just the palace. To the right of that is the house of the Lord. So Solomon would get up every day and he would see the house of the Lord to keep his mind on the Lord. And here were all of the buildings that he built surrounding his palace in that area. Here is the porch of the throne. It was in this building here. All right, so here is one picture that I thought was pretty good. At least they had the lions right. But you don't get to see the ivory throne very well. So obviously there's Solomon there, and someone is coming to see him. And you can barely make out the throne. And perhaps they were unsure how to draw it. So the best thing to do is to put a column in front of it so that you don't have to show what it is. Kind of like Bob Ross, the painter Bob Ross. This is your world. You could do whatever you want. All right, so where does the ivory come from? Well, ivory is the Hebrew word shein, and it means tooth. And so the ivory, or the elephant tusks, was most likely imported from India or Africa by these Tyrian traders. So as we're looking at this, take a look at verse 22. 1 Kings 22, we'll jump ahead. But it all fits together. "For the king had at sea the ships of Tarshish with the ships of Hiram. And once every 3 years, the ships of Tarshish came bringing gold and silver, ivory and apes and peacocks. Ezekiel also mentions it as well. It says, the sons of Dedan were your traders, talking about Tarshish. Many coastlands were your market. Ivory tusks, there you have it. And ebony they brought as your payment. So, all right. So naturally, I want to see how big tusks are. I want to see what is the world record of tusks, not necessarily from hunting. They have sometimes elephants in parks that there's no hunting, and of course they watch them grow and they see how large their tusks are, and when that animal dies, they keep the tusk. But this one was shot. This one was is on record to be the world's record biggest tusks of an elephant that was shot. And underneath that picture, it said the world record tusks taken from an elephant shot near Mount Kilimanjaro in 1898 by an African slave of the ivory trader Shunti, a Zanzibar Arab. So certainly some validity to that. Has there been any bigger? There's a little controversy. I don't want to get into this. I'll have everybody reading the book by Kilimanjaro Bell, who was an elephant hunter. But he does claim that across his travels, he heard of tusks that were bigger. I don't know. I didn't read him. I don't know. But I know him a little bit. Capstick talks about him. Wow, we are really digressing here. Anyway, look at the major tusk. So there's a major tusk and a minor tusk. One always seems to be longer than the other, unless it's a typical. So these, most of them are non-typical. The weight of the major tusk is 226 pounds of ivory. So is a tusk hollow like an antelope horn? No, it is hollow at the very top, the very head of it, where it attaches to the elephant. But when that's pulled out, most of it, the majority of it, is solid. And that would make a lot of cue balls, wouldn't it? The length of it was 10 feet, 2.5 inches. So it almost doubles these guys. I don't know if they got the smallest servants they could find there to, you know, like you, when you're getting a picture taken of your animal, you're sticking it out as far as you can. I don't think so. Anyway, it was 10 feet and 2.5 inches, and the circumference at the biggest part was 24 inches around. So anyway, this is pretty incredible. Now, there are some elephants that are around in our time. This is actually a female, and it does seem to show that their tusks don't get as thick. But this is so long that it touches the ground. That's pretty incredible. Now, that's rare. When people... Well, let's just say that's rare. Today, sportsmen that are allowed to take elephants... the tusks are much, much smaller now, you know, because all of those others have been taken. And poaching is a real big problem, always has been over there, because of the valuableness of these tusks, of the ivory. Now, I want to mention one thing, and that is when we're talking about Solomon's throne, some have suggested that it was a wooden throne and then overlaid with ivory. That's possible. But what does the text say? The text says the king made a great throne of ivory and overlaid it with refined gold. It almost seems to me that it wouldn't be, you know, you have a wooden throne, then you overlay it with ivory, then you overlay it with gold. Well, what's the sense of saying it's an ivory throne? It may be, but I don't know. Could you make a throne out of ivory? Yes. I mean, you could make it out of these tusks. I mean, you could probably make it with just those two tusks from the world record. And then it was all overlaid with gold, which is what? Going along with Solomon's decor for everything, including and especially the temple. All overlaid with gold. And then as he made his palace, much of that was overlaid with gold as well. So we know elephants come from India. It might have been imported from them. But it seems like some of the biggest ones come from Africa. So we might assume that that has come there. Now notice verse 19. It says, there were six steps to the throne and a round top to the throne at its rear, and arms on each side of the seat, and two lions standing beside the arms. So first of all, I want to talk about the round top. We'll talk about the steps and the lions in just a moment. But what's a round top? Well, the Hebrew word for top is rosh, means head. It means that this throne probably had a canopy over it, a round canopy of some sort, probably made of gold. And it was just, again, what takes your attention when you would come into the judgment hall. That's exactly what you would see. And something that 1 Kings doesn't mention, but 2 Kings does, and I'll just read it. Again, we have the parallel between 1 Kings and 2 Chronicles. And sometimes you get a little bit extra in one or the other. It says there were six steps to the throne and a footstool in gold attached to the throne. Of course there was. So he had a golden footstool. And then it talks about the side arms, and it talks about the lions. Now, at some point, it seems almost as if we could very well start to become suspicious about Solomon. I think we're going to see that in the very end of this chapter. It seems like some of it, just there was no need to go into all the wealth. But then again, you know, we go back to the very beginning. Why did Solomon overlay the entire temple in gold? Because he wanted to glorify God. He wanted to give God, as far as humanly possible, the greatest exaltation and adoration. And if you also remember, God promised Solomon, when he asked Solomon, said, what would you ask of me? And Solomon said, I would ask of wisdom. God said, because you didn't ask of riches and wealth, I will give you that too, alongside of it. So on the one hand, we're looking at what God promised to fulfill. And these were the glory days and a very safe time for Israel. And this is as good as it gets, because when we start going through the book of 1 Kings, first thing we're going to hit is a divided kingdom. The kingdom is not divided at the moment. So let's talk about the lions. I don't have any pictures of lions. We could go for the world record lion, but we didn't do that. Anyway, let's talk about this. So verse 19 stated that the throne had arms on it, and on either side was a lion. So the lion is in the symbolism, and we'll talk about that in just a moment. Then coming up to the throne were these six steps, and there were lions on each side, so that's 12 lions. Now, some have suggested that maybe 12, because it's the number of the 12 tribes of Israel. Possibility. The other one was suggested by Kyle and Dalich, and they said, no, it means that he has rule over the 12 tribes of Israel, which is a real possibility, because it's still saying that it is a united kingdom and he has one rule, just like David ruled over. Now Solomon is ruling over, and that will come to an end. Lions. Well, why lions? Well, lions have surely symbolic meaning to it. One is there's ruling authority, and the other one, of course, is their strength. So as far as ruling, if we're going to find anything in the scriptures, you remember God said about Judah that Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He couches, he lies down as a lion who dares rouse him. So even then, the lion had the reputation of being the king of the jungle. But it's the idea of ruling. He does what he pleases and no one thwarts him. We also see this in other places too. Numbers 24, talking about Israel and not necessarily Judah. It says, God brings him out of Egypt. He is for him like the horns of the wild ox. And you got to appreciate this. Whenever it talks about horns or the horn of salvation, horns always meant strength. So, I think that's a biblical precedence that your husband can mount his game because that's the idea. It's a biblical symbol. Just kidding. When I have premarital counseling, I hand out a flyer, a little application, and it's just an icebreaker. It's not to be psychologically understood. But one of the questions I have on there is, where does the husband put his mounted game animals? A, in his den. B, in the bedroom. C, in the garage. Or D, in the trash. You know, I want to make sure, right from the very beginning, we're not going to have a problem in these marriages. So that we get to the other way. The other question is putting on makeup while driving is a necessity at times. B is suicide, and I forget what the others were. And that's another one that we chuckle, but hopefully, like 40 years later, some couple won't come to me and say, well, you know, you never told us about that. All right, so as we talk about the lions then, the horns of the wild ox, he will devour the nations who are his adversaries. So there's a ruling strength there. He will crush their bones in pieces and shatter them with his arrows. He couches, he lies down as a lion, and as a lion, who dares rouse him? Blessed is everyone who blesses you, and cursed is everyone who curses you. Now that was pronounced among Israel, not just Judah. But I want to just take a moment for an application here. Turn with me to Revelation chapter 5, verse 5. So in heaven, I believe this is a picture where the church has already been raptured. We're viewing this, and John is up there, and John finds out about the book with the seven seals needs to be opened, but they can't find anyone to open it until one comes forth. And it's an elder who tells John in verse 5 of chapter 5, and one of the elders said to me, "Stop weeping. Behold the lion that is from the tribe of Judah, the root of David, has overcome so as to open the book and its seven seals." So he is the one who's going to open it, but he's called the Lion of Judah. And certainly speaks of the root of David. It speaks of authority. It speaks of kingship. It speaks of rule. And what's going to happen when the book is opened and the seven seals? Going to be absolutely tribulation, going to be wrath coming on the world, going to be judgment, and it comes from the Lion of Judah. So, in a way, one wonders if the symbolism that we see there with Solomon's throne, if God hasn't superintended that so we would get something more of the true one who's going to take the permanent seat on the throne of David. All right, well, next, verse 21, we come to the drinking vessels. And again, the author of this is just reporting this. He's reporting this because they're letting all of the Israelites know down through history God's great blessing promised to David with his son Solomon and being the most wealthiest, glorious king. Verse 21 says, "All King Solomon's drinking vessels were of gold, and all the vessels of the house of the forest of Lebanon were of pure gold. None was of silver. It was not considered valuable in the days of Solomon." So the first thing, again, is this decor. Everything is made of gold. I guess if you have it, use it, right? I don't know. But the author comments that silver was not valuable, although there will be some uses for silver. But by the way, I checked the price for silver. 1 ton of silver today, according to Calculate Me, is worth $713,708, which is a far cry from what we read for the worth of the gold. Now, just as an incidental note, these are the same drinking vessels that Belshazzar takes in the book of Daniel. You remember what happened? According to Jeremiah, these kings are going to not lead. They're going to separate. The northern kingdom goes into exile first. Then Judah, the southern kingdom, goes into last. They come in. The Babylonians siege the Jerusalem, including the temple. They carry away everything in there, the gold and the golden drinking vessels. Now, they must have stored them. And here's Belshazzar. And let's turn to Daniel chapter 5. So he was an ungodly king, and he's a king there. And he's drinking and partying, and he says, "Hey, I got an idea. Let's go get Israel's golden vessels, and let's drink out of them." Well, if you go to Daniel chapter 5, look at verses 3 through 5. This is what he does just before the writing on the wall. It says, "Then they brought the gold vessels that had been taken out of the temple, the house of God, which was in Jerusalem, and the kings and his nobles, his wives, and his concubines drank from them. They drank the wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Suddenly, the fingers of a man's hand emerged and began writing opposite the lampstand on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw the back of the hand that did the writing." And of course, it was going to be the message. And if you go drop down to verse 26, it was "Mene, mene, tekel, upharsin." And it says, "This is the interpretation of the message. Mene means God has numbered your kingdom and put it to an end. Tekel, you have been weighed on the scales and found deficient. And Perez, your kingdom has been divided and given over to the Medes and the Persians." And verse 30 says, "That same night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was slain." So we do find out that when Cyrus the king allows Israel to go back, they are allowed to take these vessels, and whatever is left, they are allowed to take back for the rebuilding of the temple, for the rebuilding of the city, and for the rebuilding of the wall. So anyway, where does that come from? Well, it came from the days of Solomon, Solomon's wealth. And so there's a history there. Now, verse 22 and 23 is going to talk about Solomon's imports. And so we're going to find out a little bit more about these ships, where they come from, where they go. And it's going to talk about the ships of Tarshish. So look at verses 22 and 23. It says, "For the king had at sea the ships of Tarshish with the ships of Hiram. And once every 3 years, the ships of Tarshish came bringing gold and silver, ivory, and apes and peacocks." So, first of all, Tarshish is a Phoenician city in southern Spain. So, I don't know if you can see this map, but here you have Jerusalem over here and Tyre, where Hiram was the king, and that's where it would come in. And then all the way over here, the southern part of Spain, you have Tarshish. So, The merchants from Tarshish would not only hit Africa and Egypt and Greece, but it is suspected they went around. And wherever there was trade and merchants, that's where they went. And then they would bring one of the purposes was they would bring it to Solomon every 3 years. Now, look at the goods that are brought, gold and silver. And you kind of wonder if silver wasn't valuable, why did they bring it? You know, but He does use silver. It's not as if he didn't like silver, but it just didn't have the value that gold has. And I guess it still doesn't. But if you've got any extra laying around, you want to get rid of them, I'll take them. So the goods consisted of gold and silver. And then here we see it, ivory and apes. Isn't that interesting? And peacocks. Ivory, apes, and peacocks suggest Africa, Egypt, and perhaps even India. So this is where they went. Some have even suggested that they went to India, which is east of Jerusalem, and came up the Red Sea. It's possible, you know. And again, if we think of Israel at a time when it's just of camels and Bedouins, it was a thriving place, and there was major trade going on in these things. Now, if you go over there today, it's kind of the same thing. You see these cities right next to the holy places, and it's hard for your mind to put it together, but you do, and you can. So all of this was just showing the wealth of Solomon. By the way, some have said that maybe peacocks meant parrots, depending on the Hebrew word. But when I was over there in Israel, to my surprise, when we were at Jericho, there were peacocks just walking around. Now, I doubt they're from the strain of Solomon, Solomon's strain. But and nowadays, anybody can have peacocks. I mean, there's peacocks in farms and all kinds of things. You can hear that obnoxious noise that they make. But look how beautiful they are. So I did get a picture of a peacock there, and I'm so glad I did because, Solomon had those. Now, some have said, okay, all right, Solomon, you know, maybe we'll go along with the throne. Maybe we'll go along with the gold lions and the ivory throne. But come on, you're starting to waste your money here. It's going to your head. Possibly, but you can't really accuse them. You don't know what's going on today. I mean, suppose they bring gold and they said, hey, have you ever seen a peacock? I've only heard about one. Well, we have one. Would you like to see it? And then maybe he said, okay, I'll take 100 of them. I don't know. But the idea is it doesn't necessarily mean he's squelched it. An apes, I don't know, maybe he had a zoo. So I know that when I went to Israel, we had a free day to do whatever. I wanted to go to the Jerusalem Biblical Zoo. I wanted to see the animals that are in the biblical times. So it's not a bad pursuit. And I don't know. I don't know if it means that he was starting to squander his money and becoming more interested in money than and was starting a downhill spiral. But what we are seeing here is that in 1 Kings 4, it talked about his wisdom, and he was the wisest of all kings. It talked about the Proverbs that he wrote, and now here we're seeing the wealth. And it's obviously the wealth is that it is so much that it has never been seen before or after according to that time. Verse 20. 4 and 25, going to talk a little bit about his fame. So not only wealth, not only imports, not only gold, but look at verses 24 and 25 for his fame. All of the earth was seeking the presence. I skipped 23. Let me go back to 23. So King Solomon became greater than all the kings of the earth in riches and in wisdom. And again, that was a promise. That's what God promised. I will give you wisdom and I will give you what you didn't ask for. So we see that side of it. Verse 24, the fame. All the earth was seeking the presence of Solomon to hear his wisdom, which God had put in his heart. They brought every man his gift, articles of silver and gold, garments, weapons, spices, horses and mules. So much year by year. So again, it just seems as if he was being inundated with all of these things. I mean, can you imagine? This is what they were bringing him. Now, some of it, I'm sure, was in trade. Like when we see a possible trade between him and the Queen of Sheba, even though there are royal gifts that are given to one another. Well, John MacArthur writes, the wisdom God has given to Solomon caused many rulers, like the Queen of Sheba, to bring presents to Solomon as they sought to buy his wisdom to be applied in their own nations. So he was like a consultant, you know. Hey, what do we do? We have this problem. What would you suggest? And he would give them wisdom from his knowledge. And look at the gifts that they brought on, you know, mules for carrying loads and things like that. All of this was part of the wealth that he and his kingdom were acquiring year after year. Well, we come to verses 26 and 29, which is the end of the chapter, and it will talk about Solomon's military from the point of view of horses, chariots, and chariot soldiers. So let's read verses 26. Let's stop there with 26. It says, "Now Solomon gathered chariots and horsemen, and he had 1,400 chariots and 12,000 horsemen, and he stationed them in the chariot cities with the king in Jerusalem." So those chariot cities, as we said, one of them was Megiddo. When I was there, they showed where they found the stalls were there, and there were supposedly some 400 stalls for horses. They were also in, some have suggested, Gezer, and then also Hazar, were just some of the ones that, because of archaeology, we come away and say, okay, maybe that's a possibility. Gezer, Megiddo, and that was the picture that you saw just a moment ago, and Hazor. All right, so in 2 Chronicles chapter 9, verse 25, you don't have to turn there, but it said, "Now Solomon had 4,000 stalls for the horses." Now you say, well, why does he need 4,000 horses, or stalls and horses, stalls for each horse, when you only have 1,400 chariots? Well, two horses per chariot and some reserve. And if you figure that out, that comes to be 4,000 stalls. So in 2 Chronicles 9:25, "Now Solomon had 4,000 stalls for horses and chariots and 12,000 horsemen, and he stationed them in the chariot cities and with the king in Jerusalem." So chariot cities possibly being Megiddo, Hazor, and Gezer. Now we come to verse 28, and here's where it gets a little interesting. In verse 28, it says, "Also Solomon's import of horses..." I skipped the first, didn't I? Well, tonight is a night of skipping. Okay, verse 27. "The king made silver as common as stones in Jerusalem, and he made cedars as plentiful as sycamore trees that are in the lowland." It's kind of a repetitious verse here, but it just shows that there was no expense in anything. And cedars came from the cedars of Lebanon, brought by the king of Tyre. Great wood, doesn't rot very easily, and it polishes wonderfully. So he even used silver, we see as well. Verse 28. "Also Solomon's import of horses was from Egypt and Kew. And the king's merchants procured them from Kew for a price." Now, here's we start to see a problem, because in Deuteronomy chapter 17, I'll have you turn there. Deuteronomy chapter 17, verse 16, when God is giving instructions for the royal authority, verse 16, he says, "Moreover, he shall not multiply horses for himself, nor shall he cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses, since the Lord has said to you, you shall never again return that way." So he doesn't even want them really near Egypt, doesn't want them bringing horses. And I think the main reason is so that Solomon or the kings do not put their trust in their military, in their horses, but continue to trust in the Lord. And we're going to see in chapter 11 This is exactly what happens. This is one of the problems that starts. So this is part of the downfall. So here's a small compromise because of his wealth. He seems to be able to do it, figures he could do it even though it's commanded not to. He goes ahead and does it. He shows that his trust isn't necessarily in the Lord, and that is the first step and the worst step. Then in verse 29, as we take a look at verse 29, let me turn there. It concludes with, a chariot was imported from Egypt for 600 shekels of silver, and a horse for 150. And by the same means, they exported them to all the kings of the Hittites and to the kings of the Arameans. Now, the Bible Knowledge Commentary suggests that he had a business on the side and he was selling these things and making money. Possibility. It goes on to say he bought a chariot for 600 silver shekels. That's 15 pounds. And a horse cost 150 silver shekels, 3 3/4 pounds. In supporting some of them exporting some of them to the Hittites and the Arameans, he presumably made a profit on them. So as we're concluding on this, we're looking at Solomon's glory, a promise and a fulfillment by God. But we're also, I think, being introduced to some of the compromises that are going to cause Solomon's downfall. And one of them, of course, is going to be wealth, which is not necessarily a problem because God promised him wealth. But perhaps his wealth is leading him astray to do whatever he wants. Now, very interesting, there have been a number of proverbs that Solomon has written about riches. And he was exactly right. Turn with me to Proverbs chapter 10, verse 15. In Proverbs chapter 10, verse 15, it says, the rich man's wealth is his fortress. This doesn't mean that a person, like a believer who the Lord blesses and they're wealthy, doesn't mean that they're sinning. But it means buyer beware. Okay? It means be careful. Because when you have all the wealth that you want and need, which you never do, but you're able to say, well, I'll do whatever I want. I'll take care of this problem. And all of a sudden, the Lord takes a back burner. So it says here, the rich man's wealth is his fortress, but our fortress, David's fortress, was the Lord. Because they're always needing something. But that's exactly what the Israelites are supposed to do, and we're supposed to do, is meet needs. Then it says, but those who love the rich are many. Everybody loves a rich man. Everybody, use him in one way or another. But in Proverbs chapter 15, verse 16, Solomon says, better is a little with the fear of the Lord than great treasure and turmoil with it. So again, we can't say that because he was wealthy, he sinned. This was God blessing him. But he needed especially to be careful that he's always continuing to fear the Lord. And he would say, look, maybe you don't have the riches of Solomon, but if you fear the Lord, you do have more riches than Solomon, at least at the end of his life. And then notice what it says, then great treasure and turmoil with it. Now, this is very interesting. If you were to talk to a very, very wealthy person, they would tell you that there's a lot of issues with it. If you have a lot of possessions, then you have a lot of possessions that continuously need your attention and your time and to be worked out. I mean, they didn't have automobiles back there, but if you think of someone who would maybe have lots and lots of automobiles, well, that's fine. Well, you've got to do an upkeep on those. And then there's all kinds of problems with it. It seems as if you have to take care of this problem today. Put this fire out tomorrow. There's turmoil with it. Again, not saying that the Lord has blessed you, you're sinning, but be careful. And then in Proverbs chapter 23, verses 4 through 5, it says, do not weary yourself to gain wealth. cease from your consideration of it. Now, this isn't saying that you shouldn't work hard and receive what is due. This is saying that don't let this become number one. Don't let wealth become number one. Don't be consumed with that. And, you know, we hear of this a lot, that, you know, we hear of a father who is working so hard that he doesn't really spend time with his children. At the end of his life, it becomes very apparent, because he's alone, because he's never invested in relationships. Now, you know, there's a balance in that. You know, you got to work hard, and sometimes you got to do what you got to do. So we understand that. But he just says, don't weary yourself. Don't consume yourself to gain wealth. Cease from your consideration. He says, by the way, when you set your eyes on it, it is gone. For wealth certainly makes itself wings like an eagle that flies toward the heavens. So that's where that original saying came from. Money has wings and it flies away. So again, this is a tremendous thing. This is a tremendous period in Israel's history. We have the wisest king. We have the wealthiest king. We have the most peaceful times. But it's all downhill from here, and it's also downhill from Solomon as well. So we'll pick that up in chapter 11.